I'm talking today with Dr. Joanna Flynn, who's the Chair of the Medical Board of Australia. Thank you for your time, Dr. Flynn.
Thank you very much.
I know it's a busy time. You've written something for our January the 16th issue on revalidation. You said in that piece that there's international evidence that about 6% of the medical workforce are not performing up to the standard they should be. Mm-hmm. But you also said that there's no data for the Australian context. The AMA, for example, have objected to that in the sense that they want more evidence.
Yes.
Why do we need revalidation if we don't have the evidence saying we need it?
Okay. So what the board's proposed are two things. Mm. One is strengthening CPD, continuing yep. professional development for all doctors, and the other is seeing what we can do to identify doctors who are at risk of performing poorly mm-hmm. earlier before they cause harm to the public and to themselves. So I think the issue about strengthening CPD is reasonably straightforward in that all doctors are required as a condition of their registration, their annual renewal, to do continuing professional development. And yep. we have some standards about what that means. And every year a doctor makes a declaration as they renew their registration to say, yes, I've done what I'm required to do. So if there's a body of evidence, strong evidence, as there is, about some forms of CPD being more effective than others, then the board believes that we should be setting a framework where the CPD that doctors do is in the effective end of the spectrum. Can do heaps of other things if they're interested, that's fine. But we know that if you want to improve patient safety and change doctors' behaviour, then they need to be looking at things that help them reflect on their own practice, interact with their peers, and look at patient outcomes where they can. Really, the strengthened CPD is a continuous quality improvement sort of model. It basically says the world's changing, we need to keep up, we need to make sure that all doctors are looking at all aspects of what they're currently doing and doing that as well as they can, mm-hmm. and the CPD framework assists and supports that. So there's plenty of evidence about CPD. I don't think that's a challenge. And for the majority of doctors, that's basically what this will be about. It'll be about trying to get more bang for their buck in terms of CPD, actually improving their practice and sustaining high standards. Then we come to the tricky bit. So what are we saying about poor performance? Well, we're saying that there's a good body of evidence that says that there are some doctors already on the radar who are performing poorly, and there are doctors who are slipping off the curve. And we know when they end up in trouble, it's very stressful and traumatic for them, and it's damaging to their patients. And there are markers that have been recognised in some communities of doctors more likely to be in those categories. And when we start to talk about those, we get a fairly scary response because we get into older males, and there yes. are lots of issues about that. But we don't know whether that's just because the older workforce has more males in it at this stage. Don't know whether it might be because people didn't do as high quality CPD earlier on in their professional careers. So the question really is, can we better understand that and how can we work towards doing better in that area?
You say there are some risk factors.
Yep.
Whose job is it going to be to identify that?
Yep. Yep.
And how do we then manage that and who yep. manages it?
Yep. So they're really key questions to which there are not yet any clear answers. I believe that it's really important that the profession collectively engages in and owns whatever the outcome of this process is, and that it ought to be something that happens locally, and where there are concerns about someone's performance or obvious markers of risk, that there's a plan in place locally to help that doctor maintain high standards. So in lots of other industries, we get contrasted with the airline industry a lot. But one of the interesting things about what happens for pilots is they get as much training on giving and receiving feedback as they do on the technical aspects of the aircraft. So we have a culture where we're not very good at that. We can see things going on around us that we're uncomfortable with in our colleagues' behaviour. But as often as not, we don't actually say anything to the person in front of us. We might talk to somebody else in the team, or we might go home and talk to our partner about it. But that's really doing people a disservice. So there's a big cultural issue here about how can we reframe our expectations about feedback and make sure people are getting feedback about their performance. And if they start to display things which potentially mean that they're not going to be performing as well as they need to be or they themselves would want to be, that there are pathways for identifying that and putting them, giving them support back onto the right path before things get to a stage where they're not remediable or something bad happens.
Do you think that the risk factors that have been identified, over 35 males, solo, small practice scenarios, is there a danger that those risk factors target certain areas more than others? GPs, for example, rural GPs, for example. Is there a danger of that happening, do you think?
There have been concerns raised that this targets GPs more than others. I don't think the age distribution in general practice is materially different from anywhere else. And I think when we talk about age over 35, essentially what we're saying is risk increases as age increases. One of the challenges for whatever comes out of all of this is that it has to actually be able to be implemented around the whole country. So we can't have a model that means that people who are in rural practice are not able to be part of whatever the processes are. And people have raised concerns about that. They've certainly said, you know, doctors are already stressed and doing too much, and now you're putting a whole lot more burdens on them. And I'm very conscious, if you put a whole lot more burdens on people, it doesn't help their performance, it doesn't help their morale, it doesn't help their mental health, and doesn't ultimately help the communities they're serving. So we're very committed not to doing that. So there's a lot more questions in this space than there are answers. In fact, in terms of CPD, lots of the rural doctors are actually very creative about CPD, and they have lots of online communities and different ways of having great peer interactions, which they can manage the logistics. They're great often at the technology side of things. We know, for instance, that people who do purely online learning in some other countries don't do as well as doctors who have a lot of interactions with their peers. But the interactions with their peers don't have to be face-to-face.
Do you see the medical board as having an active role in this when once it's up and running?
The board's role is to set standards, clearly. Yep. So the standards for CPD is absolutely the board's domain, but there's no suggestion that CPD should be taken out of the hands of the colleges. So what the board would be looking to, I think, is to revise the standard that we set about what colleges' CPD programs need to meet. And it would still be, you know, a menu of offerings for different doctors, but they would need to choose something from entree, main course and dessert, not just all dessert. In terms of the models for doctors at risk, that's really where we haven't got a clear handle on that yet. And as I said earlier, there's lots of evidence that if problems are identified early and dealt with locally, that leads to the best outcomes. And a lot of work that's been done in the US, particularly at Vanderbilt, shows that about 80% of doctors who are sort of falling off the track, early feedback gets them back on track and nothing else needs to happen. So I don't want the board to be involved in that sort of process. The board should really only have a role where there's a clear risk to the public emerging. So that would be a doctor perhaps who's actually not taking part in the processes at all, having been identified in the processes as potentially being underperforming, won't engage in whatever the next steps are in terms of further assessment or remediation, further educational support, or where something is identified in those processes that presents a current, present, real risk to the public. Clearly, there's a threshold that you'd need to be across before you ought to be in the board's regulatory space.
Right. Do you think there's a gap between what the public thinks doctors should go through in terms of review and what doctors believe they need?
Yes. Yes, there is. And we've published some social research which shows that gap. So it shows that the public believe that doctors ought to be and in fact are being kind of reviewed more often than they are. So in general, doctors think that it should only happen if there's a problem, whereas the patients think it should happen on a sort of five-year basis or some kind of basis. Doctors generally think that they do know what they need to keep them up to date, and they generally think that they're doing it, and I think they're probably right in relation to that. But as I said, we want to make sure that that continues to be the case into the future. Medicine's getting more complex, society's getting more complex. There is, however, a temptation to sort of go for a very simple solution to make it look good, and the board's is committed not to doing that. So it would be possible to design a 200-question multi-choice test that every doctor in Australia had to do every 5 years, say, but it would be completely meaningless because the context of practice, the scope of practice of doctors in Australia, you know, there are, I don't know how many, we've got 108,000 registered doctors. Well, there'd be at least, you know, 40,000 different sorts of practice. We want to create tools that help people to reflect on their own practice and give them the feedback that they need to make sure that they're performing and continue to improve their performance in relation to what they themselves expect and the community expect. But we want some mechanism where that's not happening to identify that and help get it back on track, which the profession itself, colleges, employers, patients need to be part of and should be owned by the profession and not need to come into the regulatory space unless it's not working.
There seems to be some paranoia out there. And the paranoia seems to be around once ARPA and the MBA have got their hands on it, it's just going to get rammed through. There's no point, blah, blah.
Yep.
Clearly, you don't have all the answers yet,
yep.
And so you're seeking answers from the stakeholders.
Yep, that's right. I understand the profession at large views ARPA and the medical board as a big bureaucratic, slow, unfriendly process. We're doing our best on lots of fronts to try and address that. This is actually board policy because it's the medical board that sets standards for doctors in Australia. Yep. ARPA administers the scheme, which includes dealing with registration applications and investigating complaints, but the board actually makes the decisions about those. But nonetheless, the boundary between the board and ARPA is blurry in doctors' understanding, and because we're so inextricably linked, to some degree that doesn't matter too much. But this is actually the board, as the body responsible for setting standards and regulating standards in the profession, really saying to the profession and to the community, okay, so what do we need to do into the future? We know that there are very high levels of trust of doctors in Australia. That's so precious.
Yes.
We need to make sure we preserve that. Yep.
Last year you wrote something for the MJA about bullying.
I did.
Are you happy with the way things have progressed, particularly in the last year, in terms of the bullying culture that yep. obviously exists?
Yep.
Are you happy with the way things are going?
Well, first of all, I think the work that the College of Surgeons did, and I was part of their expert advisory group, absolutely shone a spotlight on a shocking set of statistics about the prevalence of bullying and harassment in surgery, but there's every reason to think that's spread across the profession. And at the same time, there have been other reports in the health sector more broadly. So it is just shocking. So the first thing for any problem is to identify it and understand how big it is. To address that requires culture change, enormous culture change, and requires the engagement of lots and lots and lots of stakeholders. And I'm really pleased to see a lot of that happening. But we're just starting this journey. People are going to need to be vigilant. They're going to have to step up to the mark. Back to this stuff I was talking about before about feedback. You know, when they see things that are happening which are not okay, they need to have ways of raising that and having the person understand that that behaviour is not acceptable. Lots of people who are bullies don't recognise their own behaviour and are shocked when somebody says, this is the way I've observed your behaviour, especially if it's a bystander, not the person who is the subject of the bullying, who's often feeling so powerless and unable to speak up for themselves.
Do you, one of the things this student mentioned was how good it would be to have an anonymous reporting system.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the way to go?
It's hard to know about that. So there, I think we need to learn from places where there are good processes in place. Ultimately, though, feedback in general needs to be specific.
Yeah.
So we certainly need to protect people who are the victims of bullying, and maybe at first the only way of doing that is having anonymous reporting systems. But to some degree, the person who needs to understand the impact of their behaviour, unless you're very specific about what behaviour it was on what occasion, doesn't really have the opportunity to understand and reflect and learn how to do things differently.
So it's a long path. Do you think it's a generational thing? Because it seems to be a cultural thing more than a generational thing to me as an outsider.
Well, there's a lot of literature about how hard it is to change culture. Mm. What is worrying is the evidence that says that victims of bullying, they themselves turn into bullies. There are examples of quite young doctors, and it's not only doctors, bullying colleagues and bullying juniors. So whether it's generation or culture, it's got to change.
Thank you for your time.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.